The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, last Thursday, as you had promised, you had a 3.5 hour answer all the questions conference call. Now, unfortunately, you couldn't answer all the questions because we had close to 1,000 people on the line, but you did answer, I think, 29 or 30 questions.
Well, we promised 45 minutes and it just kept going and going and going. And the questions were fantastic. The quality of the questions and the sincerity of those asking, trying to figure out what is happening, why, and what they should be doing in light of it. So,
David, I have to say, I'm very humbled when I hear the people who listen to this commentary, the people who do business with us, the questions that they were asking. And this was in the face of gold dropping severely on, you know, a couple of days before that occurred. I thought I'd hear panic in their voice. I didn't hear panic in their voice. I heard maturity. And the questions that they were asking were long-range questions about, are we doing the right thing? Should we be doing more of it? And, you know, gold specifically, let's talk about the years that your family's been in business. There's been a number of times when you could purchase too high.
And a part of what we reflected on in the conference call was the fundamentals that have been driving the gold market during this period of time. There were periods of technical weakness as well. And in the last 12 years of a bull market, there were opportunities to have paid the highest price yet paid.
Well, let's go back 12 years.
So,
okay.
So you bought high when you paid $330 an ounce.
And right.
Then subsequently had to wait 12 to 16 months for the next up move. And you bought high when you paid $430 an ounce.
Right.
And again, you had to wait between 12 and 16 months for a breakout. And then you paid an incredibly high price when you bought gold at $730 an ounce and waited, again, 12 to 16 months through a consolidation, ultimately a period that was exhausted on the downside, and then an uptrend again 12 to 16 months later.
The detractors said, oh, they'll never break 1,000. You're going to be paying too high. And yeah, you bought high when it broke 1,000 at 1,030, right?
And that was a high price to pay, and you waited again another 12 to 16 months before you had an uptrend reassert itself. And imagine the psychological damage, particularly having paid in nominal terms a higher price than ever recorded in U.S. dollar history. So, you know, 1,030, you rung the bell, and you probably had to explain to your wife, maybe you didn't say a word about it,
yeah,
that you had bought gold at over $1,000 an ounce, and now it was trading closer to $750, $800 an ounce. But again, that consolidation opened up, and again, you bought high when you paid $1,920 an ounce, and now we've waited 16 months, maybe right, we wait 18, maybe we wait 20 months for a renewed breakout. But what we have seen is that we've held support at the lower 1500s. We've stayed above 15, 1530, and we can assume that we're closer to an upside move with every passing day. So again, a move below 1500 will require some reappraisal, but holding that 15 to 1535 level, we see a growing probability of 2013 setting new highs. We'll battle through 1800, we'll move well above 2000 an ounce, and the longer this consolidation takes, the more likely we are to not only put in new highs, but surprise everyone on the upside for this year. Ian McCavity, who's been a guest on our program before, he recently asked the question, by the end of 2013, does anyone seriously fear any risk of a sudden outbreak of fiscal or monetary integrity by the central banks of the U.S., Europe, Japan, or the U.K.?
So what are the chances of integrity actually re-entering the system this year, is what he's saying?
Well, and frankly, even this week, we had the congressional hearings with Ben Bernanke going before them and saying, hey, listen, you know, contrary to what the minutes have said last week in terms of our internal discussion, we're very comfortable with our policies, and we see that there's some downside, but we see far more benefits from the asset purchases that we're making, the billions in mortgage-backed securities and the billions in the treasury market. We are seeing traction in the economy. We see the economy growing as a result of what we're doing. Now, I mean, honestly, I have a very different appraisal of the economic benefits, and I also have a very different appraisal of whether or not we're seeing traction gained as we speak. Quite the opposite. I think as we move towards the March FOMC meeting, as we get some numbers on month end for February, I think we'll see further deterioration. Could be wrong on that, but it looks that way to us in terms of housing, in terms of industrial demand, both in Europe and in the United States. We see some major headwinds following what was an incredible period of stimulation last part of 2012 and first part of 2013. Why do we say first part of 2013? You know, there was an extra $41 billion that got captured in terms of income coming into that fourth quarter. It was an extraordinary $41 billion because that was extra dividends paid. Extra dividends paid, extraordinary one-time dividends that companies wanted to get to their shareholders before the change in tax code at the beginning of 2013. So, you know, again, we'll see some filtering through in the first quarter. Our main concerns are when we get to the second half of this year, what exactly is driving growth other than central bank printing presses?
Well, David, talking about Fed policies, what you're talking about when they're satisfied with what they're doing, what we're talking is printing of money. The Fed balance sheet has increased. In fact, you know, how much money was erased in the stock market crash period of 2007 to 2009?
Well, and the numbers everyone knows, but there's an interesting reflection, again, from Ian McCavity here recently, where he points out that between 2007 and 2009, there was $9.2 trillion in U.S. equity market cap.
But that's been restored.
Stock market valuation that was erased. And that, you're right, that has been restored.
Right.
At what cost? And that's where we've seen gross federal debt since that time grow by $7 trillion, and we've seen the Federal Reserve balance sheet expand by over $2
trillion. Okay.
So you're 7 plus 2.
That's 9. That's what we lost. We've restored it, but we've restored it through debt.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the recovery in equities is really just a bailout for today's investors with the bill for services rendered, quote unquote, being added to the intergenerational tab. Again, it took $9 trillion in debt to replace value from the equity washout.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, our primary concern is that another dip and the bailout capacity is already stretched thin. Another dip in the equity market, and again, you have this sort of idea of socialization of risk. Well, another socialization of risk could well be the precipitating event for a bond market rout and a complete reappraisal of paper assets in terms of their value and risk imputed in them by the general public. And our sense is we are quite close to the last hurrah for the equity markets.
Well, and David, you've pointed out in the past, okay, if we look at who's bailed out and how the bubbles moved, okay, we had the tech stock bubble back in the late 90s. That crashed, but that bubble was moved by Greenspan, by lowering rates and printing money over into the real estate market, okay, easy loans.
But the beneficiary also became the bust. I mean, so the beneficiary represented the bubble and ultimately the bust. Then you had, again, the real estate bust, and who was on the hook? The banks were on the hook, and the beneficiaries of this bailout,
right,
and arguably this bubble, are related to banks, not just banks, but the whole credit system.
But we're out of bailout people. We went to the source. Now the government has socialized everything, and the next bubble popping, you've pointed this out before, there's no one to bail them out.
Well, except that they have tools that they can employ that will offer them time to try to solve the problem. What are those tools? These are the tools that we see in motion today that Ben Bernanke has said, listen, we're quite comfortable with them. We will continue to monetize. We don't see a connection between monetization and inflation. Inflation expectations, as he says from cue card number 72, is inflation expectations are well anchored. And so, again, from his ivory tower, he sees no inflation, which doesn't really explain the base level frustration that you have from people on the street dealing with rising fuel prices, dealing with rising grocery costs, dealing with the basics of life on the increase, even while interest income and income in general is flat. So that's the struggle. Now, when we look at the markets, as long as we have a Dow theory non-confirmation and an apparent topping formation in the S&P, we feel that the risks are lopsided for stockholders. And the real surprise for most market participants this year, 2013, may well be gold putting in new highs and the equity market selling off 10 to 25%. A reversal of what we saw last year. Even though gold finished the year strong with a 6% gain, it was nothing compared to what it could have been. And again, equity markets outperformed. So the great reversal in expectations would be underperformance in equities and outperformance to whatever degree in the gold and silver space. Will we see that 2013? We think the world's central bankers are pushing a lot into the pipeline and focusing us in that one particular direction.
Well, what's interesting too, David, is the election year is over. Okay, there's nothing to prove now from at least the political side of things for a couple of years. And usually when we have the first half of a presidential cycle, when the president's not trying to get reelected or get another of their party elected, that's usually when the stock market suffers, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And again, if you're looking at presidential cycles, it's the first half which has the most vulnerability. 65% of all down years in stock market history, well, at least going back 100 years, recorded by the S&P were in the first half of the term. 65% of the down years were in the first half of the term. Again, so we look at the spending, the extraordinary measures in place. We look at a lack of organic growth in the economy.
Well, new taxes. We've got new taxes coming in.
New taxes, all of those things. New taxes, yeah, you've got 77% of households experiencing an increase in taxes via the payroll tax increase. And you can see a picture taking shape with, again, the consumer on hold.
Mm-hmm. Okay, David, if they're on hold, is it possible that we're going to actually test and fail the 2000 and 2007 levels that we've had before?
Well, exactly. So the equity market peaked in 2000. It recovered and hit new highs or equivalent highs in 2007, and we're back at those levels. Would that, again, will we break through it? And we think no, not on this go-round. Hmm. Would that bring us quickly into bear mode? What won't go up, in our view, must come down. And we've come up this far. We didn't make any ground in 2007 to speak of. And to us, it looks a lot like that 1966 to 1982 bear market period. But remember that each successive market intervention that the Fed has put in motion over the last 5-6 years, it increased equity values. And so it did accomplish one particular goal. But it did less and less of that. So there was a diminished return with each expansion of the Fed balance sheet and creation of credit into the system.
So the more they put in, the less impact it has. Even though it's a positive impact short term, it's reducing its value.
Less bang for the buck. And now you've got dissenting Fed voices which are acknowledging this. Bernanke is, of course, immovable from his position of accommodation. And I mean immovable because you saw even in this week's interview, Congress got to ask lots of questions, and he, in a very, I won't say smug, but very confident and, well, immovable is the word, way, said, we like what we're doing. We're going to continue doing it. We don't see any negative impact from it. And again, we would probably ask him to check into the real world occasionally and just see what the implications are of the kind of accommodation he's put in place. And frankly, he's reset the standard. All world central banks today, I exaggerate, maybe 50 of your main central banks, which are most of your world central banks, they have done the same thing. They've lowered rates to the zero bound, and you have a low to negative interest rate environment globally. So the frustration that you have with investors is, how do I pay my bills? How do I make ends meet? How do I keep my rate of return sufficient to meet my retirement objectives? And this is where you begin to see investors take on more and more risk. They're taking on more and more risk because they have to.
Right.
And what does that really mean? The Fed policy and the central bank policies, which mimic the Fed's policies, are creating more systemic risk than we've ever had in the market before. You look at 2007 as a period that was fraught with market risk, and you could argue that given now a 5-year period of low to negative interest rates, we have created stimulus on a scale never seen before in world history and central bank history, and can we assume anything less in terms of the creation of bubbles? We will see bubbles, and unfortunately, we'll see them burst as well. Where will investors be? How do they protect themselves? That's a different question. That's a separate conversation.
Yeah, David, after listening to Ben Bernanke, and just like you said, there's almost a smugness that comes across that these things are working, but it is reminiscent of a central banker of history, 1920s is what I'm thinking.
Right. Well, when Haverstein was doing what he was doing as sort of the wunderkind in Germany.
He was the genius.
He was. And, yeah. And it was a very simple problem to solve. Prices were on the increase, and therefore to meet the need of people who had to pay higher prices, he made more money. And so there was more money in the system, and people had more money, and they paid more for those same goods and services, and lo and behold, the prices continued to rise. Well, this is what, in essence, we're doing today, just with credit instead of printing presses. Oftentimes we talk about the quote-unquote printing presses, and what we're really talking about is an expansion of credit, because we don't have to do something as arcane and antique as print dollars, we get to create credit with the keys on our keyboard. Mm. With the click on a mouse, we can instantly create trillions. I mean, this is the beauty of the modern era. We can go from zero inflation to hyperinflation, not even with a 2-3-4 month time lag as the printing presses get revved up, but we can do it instantaneously because, again, it's digital. It's a digital phenomenon.
Well, David, sometimes we talk about collapses and think that they're this one-day event. Okay, the stock market, it just goes down, you know, thousands of points. There's blood in the streets, and everybody goes, oh, well, these guys were right. There's a bear market. But, you know, I think of some of the bear markets that were inflation-ridden, that actually the market didn't do a whole lot for years and years and years, but the inflation just ruined the buying power of those stocks.
Well, right, and that's where we see the 66 to 82 bear market is most similar to what we're in today in equities, which was basically a sideways movement, you know, range-bound. And the problem was, when stocks are not going up, if inflation is low, then you have no problem. And if inflation begins to creep up, then your real rate of return goes from being flat to being negative.
Right.
And it was that last 5 to 7 years of the 66 to 82 period which wrecked real returns and left people very despondent, very discouraged. And, you know, you started to see newsprint that basically this was the death of equities. Nobody wanted to be in equities. Nobody wanted to be an equity investor. Why? Well, again, you go with zero return for a long period of time, 10, 12, 15, almost 20 years, and then on top of that start sucking out 5% a year, 7% a year, 12% a year, 13% a year on top of the inflation that got sucked out the year before. And now you're looking at your total return for that time span. And yes, you have given away a fortune. It is a way that government increases taxes surreptitiously, increase mm-hmm. the inflation rate, and it does help their project considerably. We are now moving towards the same circumstance. Higher levels of inflation, again, with many central bankers targeting 2%. We've got Japan and the BOJ suggesting that 3% might be a better target, again, to break the back of deflation. But again, this is in the context of a low-yield world. The inflation story is one that is massively discounted today. And I say this because, you know, in the category of unhedged risks, everyone is aware of deflation. They look at our credit markets, they look at the growth of credit over the years, and they know and they think that there should be some sort of a credit unwind. What are the consequences from a deflationary standpoint? So the deflationary tail risk, frankly, is already insured against. The system has tried to cover that bet thoroughly. It's not going to come as a surprise. A black swan event is something that is unexpected, out of the blue, and no one saw coming. Basically, everyone on Wall Street is focused on one tail of the Gaussian curve and saying that over there, that is our concern. We can't let that happen. And guess what? They're ignoring the other end of the curve. No one expects to see inflation, let alone hyperinflation.
Let me interrupt you here, though. There is somebody who expects hyperinflation, and we've had him on as a guest a number of times, John Williams. He's sticking to his guns. John knows how to analyze the numbers. He knows history. And he understands what occurs when you print too much worthless money.
Well, and it's interesting because our PhD money mandarins are too smart for that to occur. That's what they consider. They look at, and even listening to Ben Bernanke this week, he basically said, listen, we've got it under control. Inflation's not an issue. We will implement our exit strategy as and when it's needed. And this is the thing. Each of the crises we've seen over the last 15 to 20 years, let alone the last decade, were unexpected, mm-hmm. with those same money mandarins saying, listen, no, we didn't see it coming, but we can tell you we will see the end of it coming, and we'll be able to adjust monetary policy just in time. How is that just in time thinking working heading into this? Why should we place confidence in their ability to undo the massive credit that has been created and put into the system over the last 5 to 10 years? And this, again, is where we think it's a pipe dream. We think it's a pipe dream, and frankly, if it's a pipe dream and the PhD money mandarins are too smart for it to occur, well, then maybe John Williams is ringing the bell and saying, yes, hyperinflation is not a pipe dream, but is in the pipeline. We don't know. So we remain convinced that higher levels of inflation are a part of the designed method to reduce debt over a longer period of time. And the Fed is playing for time because inflation is their friend. And if they can run a 4% rate of inflation, but report a 2%, that is chipping away, and we're paying back our creditors with cheaper and cheaper dollars every year that goes by. The real inflationary concern is only going to kick into gear for them when they lose control. And that, frankly, is with a snap in the bond market as investors and central banks move to the exits on a reappraisal of risk. Is that this year? No, I don't think that's a 2013 event. But for the U.S. bond market, that could very well be a 2014 to 2016 event. In that time frame, all of a sudden, you go from 0 to 60. We have no inflationary concerns to, boys, we better be able to rein this in because it's getting out of control. And again, it's one of those things where if you don't anticipate, you don't get to buy the cheaper insurance for it. The bond market is obviously a concern here.
Well, and you know what's interesting? That strategy seems to work when you're the only guy in the ring, okay? If you're the only guy in the ring, you can create inflation and say, you know what? It's our reserve currency. It's your reserve currency. We can devalue it. But like you said,
our dollar's your problem.
There are 40 to 50 central banks worldwide who are going, wait, this works. We're going to go ahead and have zero interest rates. We're going to print money. And so the currency wars that we've been hearing about, they are in full-fledged gear.
They're heating up, and they're divided, as Michael Pettis has recently said, into two camps, those that overtly participate and those that covertly participate and undermine their trade competition. The yen is now leading the pack. And of course, there's going to be a jockeying for position. Who is leading on the downside? But the yen, compared to the euro, this is mind-boggling. The yen is now down 35% compared to the euro in just a few months. Now, imagine what the execs at Toyota and at Lexus are thinking right now.
Oh, they don't mind a bit.
Imagine if you are a firm in Japan, and now all of a sudden, you've got amazing trade competition. Now, does BMW, Mercedes, and
sure.
VW, do they feel the same way? No, actually, this is very frustrating to them. This is why in the G20 meeting most recently, they're talking about currency wars. They're talking about competitive currency devaluation and the fact that, well, hey, if the Japanese are going to do that, then they either need to cease and desist, and if they don't cease and desist, then the euro may have to be devalued as well. Now, they haven't gone that far in the conversation, but as sure as night follows day, if the world enters into a period of devaluation, everyone participates. Again, Michael Pettis's comment, it's whether or not you're doing it overtly on an announced basis or covertly and pretending that you're not doing it at all and you just complain about others doing the same.
Well, and there is a cost to currency wars. The more money you print, like we talked about before with inflation, that inflation can creep in, but countries cannot keep interest rates down forever. So what does this mean for the bond market when, after they've played with fire, when we start to actually have the consequence?
Well, isn't it fascinating that FINRA 2 weeks ago started warning on duration risk in the bond market? I mean, so FINRA is a body that polices, so to say, the financial industry. They're not in the business of consumer protection per se. It's certainly not consumer investment advice. And here is where they are going beyond anything they've ever done before. FINRA is announcing that, yes, if you have an increase in interest rates, that is the same thing as a major sell-off in bonds. You will lose value. Watch out for duration risk. Don't own long-term bonds. Be careful what you own if it's a long-term bond. This is FINRA. This is absolutely unprecedented. Now, if we do see, you know, if you just want to take the other side of this, if you do see a sell-off in equities here in the next several months, you will see a return to bond buying for quote-unquote safety. And you've got the 10-year treasury, which today is in the 1.8, 1.9 range, which will slip to 1.7. We may even see it test the lows of 1.43, which we put in last summer. This is our opinion. This would be a period of time, again, where interest rates are contracting on the basis of panic in the stock market. All theoretical, but run through the scenario in your mind. If stock markets begin to sell off, you'll see a migration into bonds. Rates will come down. The value of bonds will go up. And this is probably the last hurrah for the bond market. A great time to be broadly divesting from bonds of questionable quality and of intermediate and long duration. So, of course, if you hold short-term treasuries or very high-quality corporates, these would be exceptions to the rule. Wouldn't have a problem with those. And obviously, if cash flow requires that exposure, maintain it. But, you know, what you're really talking about is intermediate to long-term bonds. And anything of a questionable quality, it's been priced to perfection. And we know we don't live in a perfect world. In fact, we live in a very frail financial world.
Well, and David, just recently you said that, you know, the Federal Reserve oftentimes talks about the stimulus as a past event. And they're looking back in the rearview mirror going, well, by golly, that worked. I'm sure glad we had Ben Bernanke there. But we've got $1 trillion in stimulus on the docket for 2013.
Yeah, and if there's something that the Fed knows that they're not letting us in on, we'd appreciate some sort of a news flash. Because again, you don't talk about the fact that you're in recovery and try to argue that it's just degrees of recovery. Do you want a robust recovery or do you want a tepid recovery? But we have recovery. Why do you even use the language of recovery when you've got the patient, the economy that is, on life support? $1 trillion worth of stimulus plus 6.25% to 6.7% deficit spending compared to GDP. These are measures which are intended to stimulate growth, but in fact, we haven't actually gotten past the dependence level on those inputs. I mean, again, we love the ER example, but if someone's on life support, right, you can't really describe them as in recovery.
No, but you know what recovery is? Recovery is the new word, like the old tastes just like chicken. Go ahead and eat it because it tastes just like chicken. Go ahead and do that because we are in a recovery. You know,
frog meat tastes like chicken. Rattlesnakes taste just like chicken. What doesn't taste just like chicken?
Right.
Well, yeah, I mean, returning to our recovery versus stabilization discussion, it would seem that record low rates and monetization of assets pressing the $1 trillion threshold, that is not Exhibit A. That is not Exhibit B for an economy that has returned to stride and is growing, in essence, has recovered.
And not just here in America. I mean, look at the equity markets worldwide. And when you see stimulus from the central banks in those countries, you see the equity markets rising.
Right. So look at the charts of any of your world equity markets. Look at Europe. Look at Asia. Look right here in the U.S. And you have to wonder what the catalyst is for taking stocks beyond peak levels. We happen to be at those peak levels now, similar to 2007 and similar to 2000. Interesting to note that all of your world equity markets were at their own version of peak numbers at the same time, 2007 and 2000. Wow. So when credit flows, all boats rise. When the tide is rising, all boats rise
with it.
And that
was just before the crashes.
Of course. Now, the catalyst may be the money printing and monetization by global central bankers. But without this extraordinary ingredient, the risks lie on the downside. It's not just an economic argument. But if you look at the groups who are now buying and selling in the marketplace, and we've pointed this out throughout this last year, throughout the second half of last year, we noted the rapid increase in insider selling.
Right. The CEOs of those companies were selling their shares.
That trend continues. Now you have fresh meat in the market, being the hopeful retail investor just recently back in the game after several years of sitting on the sidelines nursing wounds from the beating they took in 2008 and 2009. Just back in time to grab the bag from insiders,
right,
that are more and more concerned. Insiders more and more concerned with what? Number one, non-resolution in Europe. Number two,
Italy.
Well, yeah. Exactly.
I mean, non-resolution,
yeah,
in Europe. I mean, it just continues.
Well, exactly. But isn't it interesting? Only in Italy can someone be on trial for tax fraud, carrying a 4-year prison penalty, and he say, well, let's put this and the appeal process on hold until after my election bid.
I have an election to win.
Yeah. So can you postpone? And they say, oh, sure, we'll just wait on that until we figure out if you're going to be the heir. This is the issue. No, we don't have resolution in Europe. We have fiscal issues and their non-resolution in the United States, or at least resolution, which includes a fleece the rich and redistribute assets to the less fortunate. What's the problem with that? It's the removal of incentive from the market-based system dependent on that key ingredient. You take incentive out of the equation and what happens? It's like going back to the period that we saw in the 1940s, during the wartime period where our economy was a complete command-control economy. What happened to private capital? What happened to business investment? It all dried up. Why? Well, if there's no incentive, I mean, if the government captures the upside,
right,
but we capture the downside, why do individuals, why do corporations take risk? They don't. They say, listen, we've got an infinite time frame. Your election is going to be in 2 to 4 years. You don't have an infinite time frame. You will be either reelected or thrown out. We will last. We will survive. We will disappear. We will go into some sort of hibernation for a certain period of time. Capital can get very, very quiet until a new regime that is more comfortable with the incentive program in the market environment comes into play.
Well, and you know, Dave, you talk about removing incentives. Of course, that's a problem for the equities market, the European non-resolution. But actually, we've been sold a bill of goods, too. We've been told that the emerging markets, even if none of this works out in the West, the emerging markets are going to pull us out. But that's fading.
Well, right. So again, you've got the insiders who are handing the bag to the man on the street. And yes, they see fading prospects of a global recovery fueled by underdeveloped countries. That leaves us with the old debt-driven growth model, the model that certainly carried us for 30 to 40 years, but is now our only default choice.
It's tired.
Well,
David,
it is tired.
It's tired.
But, so we look at the FTSE, we look at the London market, we look at the DAX, we look at the German market, we look at the S&P, and even the underperformers have recovered some of their losses from the 08 debacle. But new ground has yet to be traveled. This is really the issue, though, because even if we did cover a little bit of new territory, let's say the Dow did break out. We talked about the Dow theory non-confirmation a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. That's in essence where the transports have moved to new highs, and according to Dow theory, the industrial average should also reach new highs, confirming that the market is in a bull trend.
And that hasn't happened
yet. If the industrials don't make new highs after the transports have, then the argument is you're not really standing on two legs. You're in a very weak environment, and it may not happen at all. The challenge is we have seen confirmations in the past, a break to new highs, and then terrible losses on the other side of that. I'm thinking of 1974, when the Dow finally reached into new territory. It broke above 1,000, went to about 1,050. You know, a good 5% move, and arguably anyone who's looking at technical confirmations of upside would say, hey, we may be moving into a new bull market. Except that we were on our way to a 45% loss immediately thereafter.
So
we
lost less than half of its value.
Yeah, we went to less than 600 on the Dow immediately thereafter. The move of that magnitude would take us to about 7,500 on the Dow.
Ooh.
Now, I mean, that may sound a bit scary, but we've been there before. We were there in 2008. Actually, that's not as bad a number as we saw in 2008. Have we dealt with the issues that need to be dealt with of a structural nature? No. Have we simply papered over them with central bank largesse? Largely, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we go from here? Ultimately, there has to be a purging, and maybe this is just too much Austrian thinking in one sitting, but ultimately there has to be some sort of a purge. The bad debts go, and you start over. You start out with something of a blank slate.
So, David, if we really did see the Dow drop to 7,500, 8,000, I mean, related to an ounce of gold, which we've tried to teach the listeners to start doing, what would that Dow-gold ratio look like at that point?
Well, take the price of the Dow at that point. Let's say 8,000 for easy math. Assume a $4,000 gold price, and it's a 2-to-1 ratio. We're at about a 9-to-1 ratio now. That implies an increase of purchasing power of 7 times. 7 times purchasing power between the 9-to-1 current and the 2-to-1 perspective. That's interesting. So, you know, that may be, in fact, the limit on the Dow gold ratio in terms of purchasing power, but a very compelling story. Where are we at? Where are we going? I don't think we'll see 7,500 this year by any stretch. We could see 11,500 on the Dow, maybe even 10,500 on the downside as a low point. But I think what really would take the Dow lower is movement in the bond market and that bubble beginning to burst. That bubble beginning to burst, and all of a sudden equities circle the drain with bonds at the same time.
Well, you know, I think of Bernanke. Let's pretend like he's sitting here with us, and let's pretend he's honest. And he goes, you know what, Dave? You're right. Okay. The equities, you can take that. I realize that the equities came up because we printed money and we stimulated. And this recovery, yeah, maybe it's not really a recovery, but, you know, we stimulated, so at least we showed positive GDP growth. But one thing you can't take away from me, I think of the song, You Can't Take This Away From Me. One thing you can't take away from me is real estate. Real estate's bottoming. It's starting to rise. Come on. Give me that.
Yeah, no, we'll give you that. I mean, and it is the success story of the Fed. Low rates are stimulating activity in the sector, and arguably that's why they're going to keep on buying $40-45 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities, and just to support that effort, an extra $45 billion. So 40 on the one hand, $45 billion in treasuries. There is an interesting thing, though, because, and I made mention of this on Bloomberg last week, that it's private equity and it's institutional capital that is responsible for reducing inventories. And, you know, basically they've turned vacant and foreclosed homes into rental pools. So they've stepped in with billions of dollars. And admittedly, this is positive in terms of reducing the overhang of product on the market. But you don't have families purchasing first-time homes. That is not return. That's not the case. You don't have people saying, listen, we've got some job security. We're not as concerned about pink slips anymore. And I think we should go ahead and take the plunge, buy the house. That's not the case. What has put a floor under real estate is investors, and particularly private equity institutional capital.
So it's not your moms and pops that are going out and buying houses necessarily yet. You know, interest rates have been so attractive. It's a hard thing to determine if you're buying a house. You know, we've talked about zero interest rate policy not working for forever. Most people who understand that, they see interest rates rising. So there's this tough question. Is real estate going to fall further? I mean, we had a market break in 2006. How long should we expect this real estate slump to last?
Well, you know, this is an issue. I mean, you could argue that you are bottoming out right now. In other words, we could have 5% downside, 15% downside, but we're a lot closer to the bottom than we are to the record peaks. And now the question is, what stimulates growth in that space? And this is where, when you look at bull markets, periods of growth, and bear markets, periods of contraction, usually a bear market lasts half the duration of the preceding bull market. We had a good 25, 30 years of growth in the real estate market. I mean, again, we're talking about secular trends, not the little cyclical, oh, well, it dropped back 1% last year. In that 30-year period, you went from interest rates being 17, 18% to being 3%, and that was jet fuel for pricing in retail housing, and it was too for commercial space and everything else. What you're likely to see here is just a dead cat bounce in terms of, yes, we've seen prices improve. They've picked themselves off the floor, but is this really reentry into a growth phase? We would argue that your best prospects for growth in real estate are around 2020, unless you're buying deeply discounted real estate in Detroit, which, you know, if you buy it for $5,000 for a single family home and can sell it for 10, you made decent money. But I mean, we're talking about a different kind of purchase.
So if a person's buying their residence, this might be a good time to buy, just if they're not trying to invest the money and make money. But for the person who actually got used to turning real estate every few months,
don't look for quick turns. This is not an investor's market in the sense that, you know, you can expect buoyant moves, 5, 7, 8% per year in the real estate space. Beyond this recovery, 2012, first half of 2013, which again is driven by private equity money and institutional capital, who's next? Who's coming in next and why? And again, we think that we've got some headwinds before that happens.
Well, David, one of the sad commentaries of what we're talking about, you can't make money in stocks without huge risk. You know, the low interest rates have forced older people and people who are income starved
into junk bonds, high yield bonds,
speculating in the stock market. Yep. But it sounds to me like the same thing is happening over on the real estate side, that you've got speculators coming in. This is not necessarily the first time buyer. This is the speculation that's pulling off this inventory at this point.
Well, that's right. And I think to have too sanguine a view on real estate at this point ignores the cost of capital. And as and when you see an increase in interest rates, you have to see a decrease in the value of real estate, the real estate that you're financing. So, you know, as a second leg down in the real estate market, you can look at the cost of capital and say that is a part of what's still at risk. Now, the activity in the real estate market today, again, if you're looking at residential mortgage-backed securities, commercial mortgage-backed securities, commercial real estate, residential real estate, you've got people moving there because they're income starved. This is investment pools seeking yield literally anywhere they can find it. And again, who's responsible for this? This is a direct consequence of Fed activity. And frankly, it's not the kind of activity that the Fed was supposed to stimulate. They are stimulating speculation. And again, this is just a pool of investors who say, I have to have some form of income. Find something for me. Okay, package together, bundle up 1,000 homes, try to rent them out if we can collect the rents and have a 5 or 6% cap rate. You manage it, take 2%, and I'm happy with 5 to 6% because look at the paltry returns I have elsewhere. In fact, I'm really happy with 5 to 6%. And if you need to leverage that fund in order to do it, great, I don't care. Just get me some yield. I guess what I'm really saying is the Fed is embedding a tremendous amount of speculation and a tremendous amount of systemic risk, a tremendous amount of re-leveraging even after 2008 and this beginning of what many thought would be a great unleveraging or deleveraging. This is the exact opposite is happening now, and risk in the market is frankly never been greater. We assume that there will be a normal washout in the commercial real estate market, a normal washout in the residential real estate market. But just like 2 + 2 = 4, as interest rates increase, you'll see a hit in those real estate markets. And that hasn't happened yet. When is it going to happen? Again, we look forward on the horizon to events in the bond market which change the nature of equities, which change the nature of bond investment, which change the nature of the real estate markets. And this is still a 2014 to 2016 time frame. We're not saying that you're going to have a massive collapse in any of these markets tomorrow. You could on the basis of some unforeseen precipitating event. But barring that, it's baked into the cake on a longer term basis in that 2014 to 2016 event. How the Fed responds will determine whether or not we have tame, mild inflation or even hyperinflation. So this may be a conversation to return to with John Williams. Do we see hyperinflation coming tomorrow? No, but in a longer term time frame, it'll be very curious to see the Fed in a classic liquidity trap trying to figure a way out of what is really a dead-end position.
So if I'm hearing you right, Dave, if we were to conclude, you know, we've talked about the stock market, we've talked about gold, we've talked about bonds, we've talked about real estate, not a lot looks good. I mean, the gold market does look good, but what I think I'm hearing you say is don't go out and speculate right now. Don't try to create dollars that maybe not really there and stay the course, maybe preserve assets through this period of time.
Well, and I think this was the bottom line of our 3.5 hour conversation slash question and answer. And for anyone who hasn't listened, it might be worth sampling through it. Some great questions asked, and I think we'll add some clarity. You know, the fundamentals haven't changed in the precious metals market. Supply and demand is fairly healthy now and looking like it will be for 2013 and 2014 as well. So what really is driving the markets today? A lot of unrealities. And so again, if you want to go long the equity market, fine, but you're betting on an unreality. Mm. You're betting on fiat currency being printed ad infinitum as a cure-all, but lo and behold, it was a part of the problem to begin with. So we remain skeptics, and is that frustrating? Well, it's frustrating to see the Dow at 14,000. So we revert back to that primary theme and objective of asset preservation. On a relative basis, I think gold has continued to do a wonderful job over the last 10, 12 years of preserving value. You've increased your purchasing power over 7 times, almost 8 times, compared to the Dow and S&P. Even with nominal values increasing in the Dow and S&P, you've still considerably improved your footprint in the marketplace by being exposed to gold, and that will continue. Again, is it a Dow gold 2-to-1 ratio? Is it a 3-to-1 ratio? It is a 1-to-1 ratio. I think 3-to-1 is a given. 2-to-1 is a high probability. 1-to-1 we may not see. But it's important to remember that it's not the prices that matter. It is these relative relationships that matter. And ultimately preserving value for you and for your family means thinking in that way a little bit outside of the box.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.